Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Suzanne Kelly, PhD. She's an independent scholar whose work spans the topics of the environment, feminism, sex, and death. For nearly a decade, she's been researching, writing, talking, and teaching about green burial. Currently, she serves as the committee chair of the town of Rhinebeck Cemetery in New York, where she led the efforts to establish a green burial ground. Kelly writes and farms in her home in the Hudson Valley. So, first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, what is Greening Death is the title of the book I have here in my hand, and which is a very good book, by the way. And what is the importance of greening death? What does it mean? What's the importance of it both physically and socially?
Yeah, well. So the title of the book is Greening Death. I guess maybe I should just begin with, you know, what is green or natural burial in its most basic way? So green burial in its most basic form is a way of caring for the dead with minimal impact to the environment. So most basically it means whole body earth burial without the use of chemical embalming fluid, without the use of sealed and treated hardwood and metal caskets, and without the use of a burial vault, which is really the trio of practices in the U.S. really since the middle of the 1800s, beginning in around the 1800s, and I can say more about that history. So that's what it is sort of at its most basic. And so it is the way that people throughout the world really mostly still continue to bury their dead. And it's the way that many religious groups actually in the U.S. Still continue to bury their dead, Jews and Muslims in particular. Although, as I point out in the book, there have actually been cemeteries have actually impeded those religious laws in some ways, creating, and in the last few years, we've seen the creation of what seems like an oxymoron of green Jewish burial grounds, actually, the first one which opened in California a few years ago, namely because many cemeteries, and I can say more about this, Jewish cemeteries included, have been requiring some sort of a burial vault or some sort of a liner. Either they invert the vault or they cut out the bottom or they drill holes in the bottom. So anyway, so that is what green or natural burial is at its most basic. But the green burial movement, which has been emerging over the last 15 years in the U.S., has other aims too, one of which includes cremation, of course, because 150 years ago, when our funerary practices started to shift, the modern crematory wasn't even on the scene yet. The first cremation in the crematory didn't actually take place until the late 1800s. And then it didn't really pick up steam until about the 1920s. And then cremation really didn't begin to take off in the U.S. until about the 1960s with the publication, mostly with the publication of Jessica Mitford's book, The American Way of Death. So the green burial movement, and I talk about green burial as a movement in this book, as a people's movement, as a social movement, must and does take account of the fact of cremation. Now, I think if you ask most people that think of themselves as green burial advocates about cremation, it's largely regarded as the second most environmentally sound way of disposing of the dead. And if it's less than ideal, that's only because anytime you burn something, you pose a threat to soil, water, and air. In parts of Europe, they've done a much better job at placing filters on crematories to filter out things like furans and dioxins and mercury, actually from dental fillings, and to find more energy efficient ways to fuel their crematories. But in the U.S., we actually have a long way to go toward those ends. So that's one of the other really central aim, I should say, of the green burial movement has to do with land conservation. And I spend some time in the book talking about that. There's about 150 green burial, well, over 100, I would say, green burial grounds that have emerged in the U.S. in one form or another. And there are only about a handful that have a real focus on conservation, preservation, and restoration of lands. Though I should say that the first green burial ground in the U.S. that was formed actually was formed with these aims of tying the fact of human death to the conservation of land. So that's another aim of the green burial movement as well.
So on a, let's talk about the physical level for a minute. What's wrong with the current ways of disposing of dead bodies?
Yeah. So this trio of practices and, I'm grouping cremation in here in the way that I described it there, only to the extent that it has some polluting factors, With the trio of factors, the use of chemical embalming fluid, the use of sealed and treated hardwood and metal caskets, and the use of burial vaults, all are unsustainable and do pollute the earth. We know that embalming fluid, while it is biodegradable, is actually made out of the well-known carcinogen formaldehyde, and that poses a threat to worker health. And there really haven't been very good studies done, even though it is biodegradable, to see what effect it actually has on the land. But the studies that have been done on the silt loam in some cemeteries in the U.S. have shown elevated levels of things like cobalt and lead and zinc, and also that come from the leaching of the modern casket, but also from the leaching of the burial vault that I mentioned before. Most cemeteries require a burial vault. Burial vaults are typically made out of reinforced concrete, but they're also sometimes made out of plastic, and they're also sometimes made out of asphalt, which we know is a semi-solid form of petroleum. So there's the polluting factor, but then there's the fact that we, and there's some, you know, statistics that I cite in the book about, you know, just the sheer, you know, tons of hardwoods that we put in the ground every year and concrete that we put in the ground every year and, you know, gallons of embalming fluid that we put in the ground every year. You know, a lot of non-renewable resources when it comes to wood and the manufacturing of concrete. So there's that element. So that's sort of the physical part of it, as you asked about it.
So, what happens? Okay, so somebody dies and then their body is embalmed, and which is meant that their natural fluids are removed and replaced with the embalming fluid, correct?
Yes.
And then a hole is dug, and there is either plastic, asphalt, or concrete is made into a sealed tomb, and then they and their casket are dropped in, and the thing is sealed up. Why? Well, before why, what happens after? What happens then to the body? And B, I mean, if it's sealed in a tomb, whatever happens to everything? It seems that means it's – well, I'll just ask you. Whatever happens. And then second, why?
Yeah, well, there's a long history, but I'll give you the quick answers first in terms of why, in terms of the vault. The reason why the vault is required today, and cemeteries require the vault today, and it continues to be used, and that even, as I said, some Jewish cemeteries have been requiring some sort of vault or liner, is so that the cemeteries can maintain their manicured look, right? So that we can have this kind of streamlined look, and so that lawnmowers can actually, you know, do their work and mow over the graves. Because if you put a body in the ground in a biodegradable container and you didn't mound it up into a burial mound, eventually there would be a divot. If you just flattened out the ground, there would be a divot in the ground. And when the lawnmower went over it, there would be basically a bit of a slump in the ground.
So they put vaults to help the mechanical lawnmower.
Exactly. That's exactly why they do it.
Sounds like a great reason.
it's a circular logic. So that's why they use it now. What was your other question? About what happens to the body. Right. So, you know, one of the things in green burial, and if you talk to green burial ground operators, is, you know, we have this idea that bodies are dug 6 feet under, but actually the best depth to bury your body for quick decomposition is about 42 inches, 3.5 feet, really no deeper than say 4 feet or 4.5 feet. And that's because you have enough oxygen in the environment for the body to quickly decompose. In many green burial grounds, like we do here in my hometown, we add what's called biomass, sticks and twigs and leaves, into the actual burial to actually create even more of an oxygenated space to make the breakdown happen more swiftly. But if you're enclosing the body in a space like the vault and a sealed casket, if that's what's being used, you know, you're eliminating that oxygenated environment. And so the body, instead of going through a quick decomposition, in many cases actually putrefies. So it's a very different kind of breakdown.
Yeah, I remember reading this just decades, actually when I was, I believe, a college sophomore, which is the right time to read about putrefaction or putrefaction. I remember reading that just in terms of sort of the disgust factor, dropping off health and everything else, that aerobic versus anaerobic decomposition of bacteria or decomposition of bodies, that in a sealed casket, you actually end up – it ends up much more – sorry
gross.
To use such a – yeah, gross. You know,
yeah.
It ends up much more gross than a regular decomposing body. So by trying to protect the bodies, they end up making it really kind of disgusting.
Yeah, because I think, you know, we have, well, many of us, I think, have this image that that's not happening at all, that the body is permanently preserved in that way, and that all of these things that we built up around it, the embalming fluid and then this sort of sealed fortress around it, is protecting it from ever decaying at all, or ever changing in any way at all, which, of course, isn't true.
So I want to sort of jump topics for a second, and I want to go with the first sentence of your book, because anytime anybody references Neil Emerdon in the first sentence of a book is a great thing. You say, it is more than a little strange, Neil Emerdon bemoaned some 30 years ago, to think of people accepting as normal a view of nature from which they are excluded. And so that's sort of the segue into, and I want to come back to, actually, let's put that on hold for a second and come back to that. Because I want to ask you first, why the embalming? Why, if we let people do these so-called green burials, term of irony there, wouldn't that just like make everybody die from communicable diseases?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I mean, looking at the history of our funerary practices and why they developed, and I mean, our funerary practices, this trio of practices, these polluting, unsustainable practices, as I trace in the book, is really about tracing a history of a fear of human decay, really, of the decay of the dead body. There is this prevailing social belief that's still very much with us, that the dead body, that the human dead body really poses a threat to public health. And that you simply can't, I mean, this is the question, the number one question I would say that I always get at the end of any community talk that I give on green burial is, you know, can you just put the body in the ground that way? Well, you can, you know, given the right arrangement, the right place, the right distance from bodies of water, et cetera. But we have this belief, and even the World Health Organization has been trying to get the public to see, especially in times of natural disaster, that, you know, the dead body does not pose the threat that we think it does, that it's best to tend to the living first and not rush to tend to the dead, which is what has been done historically in times where there's been, you know, a lot of deaths all at once. So, so the history of funerary practices in the U.S. is really about a war on decay that begins really in and about the 1830s in the U.S. And I could talk about that history a little bit if you'd like.
Yeah, I would love for you to go there in a second, but I'm also thinking, yes, please do go there.
Okay, great. So our funerary practices really changed, the linchpin of the changing really happened with the Civil War, and I'll get to that in a second, but it really started to happen before the war, in and about the 1830s when, there was new fears around sanitation kind of collided with a rise in urban population. And this was on the heels of sanitation reforms happening in Europe as well. So this is when there were diseases like cholera and yellow fever that were spreading through these new emerging American cities like wildfire, and reformers were trying to figure out like how to stop the spread of them. And this was before we fully understood that it was actually germs that got into the body and caused us to get sick and even die. It was believed that actually, the smell of things, the stench of things could cause us to become sick. And so they started setting their sights and focusing their attention on really stinky places in the culture, like, you know, places of human waste and of garbage, and also, believe it or not, on our graveyards. Before this time, before we had the development of what we now know as these cemeteries, really, in the U.S., we had people were either buried, you know, on the back 40, you know, on the family farm, or they were buried in sectarian church graveyards in cities, villages, and towns. These were not places where the living really went to spend time with the dead, unlike, you know, cemeteries today. These were actually really not well-kept places. They were often stinky places. They would sometimes dig up bodies to make room for other bodies for fresh burials. And so people were sort of used to, in some towns, used to living with the presence of smelling, rotting, you know, bodies. What started to happen in around the 1840s was that cities, towns, and villages started to place bans on burials within the village, town, city limits. And this happened everywhere in the U.S., including even my hometown, which at that time had about 2,000 people. They placed a ban ultimately that stuck in and around the 1850s. And what happened then was that they still had to bury people, but where were they going to bury them? Well, they started to bury them on the outskirts of town. And this gave rise to what we know is called the rural cemetery movement. The rural cemetery movement was really all about our first civic cemeteries. These were non-sectarian cemeteries where people actually used to go and spend time in them. These were really our first parks in the U.S. These were really well planned out bucolic oases where people would spend weekends there, spend times with their families, have picnics, have weddings, etc. And so a lot of good actually came out of this forcing the dead out of the place of the living. We got these beautiful spaces. However, we forget that the reason why they were created at all was because of this erroneous fear of the dead that we actually had to guard against them, that we had to guard against the decomposition of the dead body and swiftly get them away from us into the ground so that they could decay quickly in this so-called natural space. So that was the first part of it. Now, the second part of it was the Civil War. For the first time, we have it wasn't so much that there were so many people dying all at once, it's that so many people were dying all at once away from where they lived. So we had Northern soldiers who were dying in the South, and mothers wanted burials for their sons. How do you get bodies back for burial without preserving them? Embalming had been practiced for thousands of years throughout the world in varying ways. It had never been practiced in the U.S., and the idea of it was not favorable. Even cutting into the body at this time was seen as something terrible. And so there were new anatomists on the scene, folks who were newly trained in this new procedure of arterial embalming, where they, you know, extracted the blood out of the body and put chemicals in the body to temporarily preserve the body. There were different chemicals used at that time. Arsenic was one of them. And so the Union Army brought in these new anatomists for those families actually who could pay for it to embalm bodies and bring them back home for burial. It was estimated that about 40,000 bodies were brought home for burial in this way. And to just give you an idea of how many, you know, people were dying in my hometown, again, there's only about, well, I don't know, there were 2,000 people in the 1850s. In that cemetery that was started in the 1850s on the outskirts of town, that same cemetery is still here, still burying. There are 750 veterans in that cemetery, and 350 of them are from the Civil War. So that's just, it just sort of gives you an idea of how many folks were dying. So that was the first part. Now, you would think that embalming would wither away because it was seen as such a terrible thing, and it was seen as a temporary solution to a terrible problem. But it didn't, and there were two reasons. The first had to do with the death of Abraham Lincoln, whose body was embalmed. They actually sawed off his head and, you know, pumped him up with chemicals and paraded him around the country through it was really an Abraham Lincoln death parade where they brought him through different cities so Americans could gaze upon his body. And some, you know, historians point to this parade as a kind of symbolic overcoming, as a kind of overcoming of a war that had parted a nation. And as I point out in my book, you know, it also points to another overcoming that really is beginning to snowball at that time, this overcoming of nature that we can clearly see developing in our death practices and elsewhere. The other part is, of course, a bit more sinister and has to do with, you know, the rise of industrialization and capitalism, which is that the chemical companies, you know, that were selling these chemicals to the anatomists started to set up workshops and they started to set up schools. And, you know, the men who had been building the coffins for bodies to be put in and then trekked out to these new rural cemeteries started taking these workshops. Prior to this time, death care was very informal work. It was not done in, you know, it was pre-market care, right? It was done in the home, usually by the women of the family or some designated women in the community. But now what started to happen was that death care started to shift not only from the hands of women into the hands of men, specifically white men for a long time. Men of color were not allowed to be embalmers early on. But they this new practice of embalming became this sort of scientific acumen that came to define the new death care work. And this gave rise ultimately to the funeral industry. So embalming, you know, this is what gave us what we understand to be as the funeral industry right now, but it hinged upon the star of sanitary science. They sort of hitched their wagons, as one historian referred to it, as to this star of sanitary science. The fear of the dead body being a contaminant, and also of course the promise of preservation. And of course, once the trade developed, you needed, you know, caskets. They needed to be able to sell things to people. And so you had these new trade magazines and it gave people an opportunity to do just that. And eventually the vault actually followed suit. So all those things were built up around the industry that was developing.
So would you rather talk next about the attempts to conquer death, or would you rather talk next about the historical role of women and talk more about that, switching over and make whatever analogies you would like to midwives versus the sort of taking over a birth by men as well? Which would you rather do first?
Yeah, I'll talk about that. That's great. You know, I think, you know, one of the points that I make in the book is that, you know, the green burial movement, as it's emerging, as it really is a budding movement, is also aligned with other movements that are happening right now, like the home funeral movement. And the home funeral movement is interesting because, and by the home funeral movement, I mean, the move, not just the move to have funerals back in the home, but really to have families direct their own funerals and take it out of the domain of the funeral industry. But what's interesting about the home funeral movement in the U.S. right now, and as it's been emerging also over the last two decades, is that it's largely being guided by women, which in some ways, as I point out in the book, is really about a return to the past. As I said, you know, death care work had historically been done by women before the rise of the funeral industry in the mid to late 1800s. And what we're seeing now, you know, with the rise of the home funeral movement is really a reversal, not just in terms of who does this death work, this death care work, but also in the reclamation of certain knowledges that have been seemingly sort of left to the past or pushed to the margins. You know, social movements are not, as we know, you know, just about changing business as usual. It's also about, you know, which knowledges get to rise to the surface and which have been pushed to the side. And what we're seeing with people, you know, gravitating toward green burial or towards the home funeral movement is about, you know, laying claim to these knowledges that we've been robbed of, that for a long time, in terms of the care of the dead, were actually in the domain of women, right? That then were ultimately forced into the hands of men or taken from the hands of women and pushed into the hands of men. And so what we're essentially seeing is really a struggle for knowledge, and that those knowledges once tapped into really can be pushed down, you know, no longer, that, that we're really seeing this resurgence in a big way. And I think that, it can't be kept back anymore.
What are some examples of the sorts of knowledge that are pushed down this way?
Well, I think that the biggest one I already talked about, which is about this idea, this prevailing social belief that the dead body and its attendant decay are really harmful to the living. One of the things that, you know, home funeral guides, I think, do time and time again is to try to, you know, demystify the death process, to make it seem okay that we can be around dead bodies, that we actually can care for our own dead, that there's no real mystery to this kind of care work. But for too long now, right, since the late 1800s, we've been handing our dead over to professionals and kind of like, you know, just turning away. I think we see this most specifically, really, as it's embodied in direct cremation, right, where the body goes en route from the morgue, you know, straight to the crematory, and we never see the body again. So I think that, you know, the home funeral movement and in tandem with the green burial movement is about death awareness, but it's largely about a focus on the dead body, about recognizing that the dead body is not this terrible, dangerous contaminant, and that we can, as we care for the living, also care for our own dead.
And what is the significance of, professionalizing that, moving it away from women? I'm thinking again about the movement from midwives to men being in charge of birth. Why is this significant? Why is it women then being taken over by men?
Well, I mean, you know, it has to do, as I said, with the robbing of knowledges, that it really is a struggle for knowledge, that is, I think that fundamentally, you know, Mary Daly talks about this, that this is really what we're looking at. Whenever we're looking at the usurpation of certain activities, we're really talking about a struggle for knowledge. But what happens is those knowledges ultimately become discredited, right? They become seen as unnecessary, as base, as bad. And these new knowledges take over, these prevailing knowledges, which seem like the right thing to do. And of course, the right thing to do ultimately can only be in the hands of those, you know, those folks in the culture who are seen as, you know, having the most power, as having the right direction, as having, you know, rationality. So it makes sense that it would be moved from the hands of women. But also, you know, the thing about embalming was embalming as a scientific practice was not seen as something that was in the domain of women. It was seen as something ultimately that women were incapable of doing because it was not within their nature, right? So only men could actually do this kind of work, this kind of cutting into the body, this kind of extracting of fluids, this kind of, you know, handling of chemicals. So it really was, the move had a lot to do with the way that we think about the work that women can do, and we think about the kind of natures that women have.
So, okay, I want to go back to, thank you so much for all this. I want to go back to the quote by Neil Emerdon. I want to put that together, oddly enough, with a quote from Deepak Chopra.
Okay.
The Neil Emerdon quote, "It's more than a little strange to think of people accepting as normal a view of nature from which they're excluded." And then I want to put that together with years and years ago, 25 years ago now, somebody handed me a Deepak Chopra book, and I only read the first page or so. And the reason I only read the first page is because on that first page, he had this sentence about death is the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And so do you see why I brought those two quotes up together?
I think so.
Just because it ties in, I guess this is the segue to talking about this culture's attempt to conquer death.
Yes. Well, this is true. And you know, I think that, you know, the so-called alternative death movement that includes the green burial movement, the home funeral movement, but that's also tied to, you know, a focus on, you know, a history that's been longer than both of these, of hospice, right, and palliative care, and a focus on advanced care directives and even on end-of-life choices. Like, I think, you know, this move toward looking death, you know, straight in the face and not turning away and recognizing that, you know, death comes to us all and death is obviously a part of life, in particular because, a la Neil Emerdon, that we in fact are a part of nature. And as everything in nature, you know, comes into being and dies away, so too will we. But somehow we've had this fantasy, right, of human exceptionalism, that somehow this won't happen to us, this kind of fantasy of immortality that, and of course, death denial, that death will not come to us all. And of course, you know, we do all these things to fight it. And in fact, you know, we can see this not only in end of life choices and, you know, in our medical industry, but we can see this even in this trio of practices that are being really challenged by the green burial movement, that, you know, building a fortress up around the dead body is in many ways about, you know, denying the fact that, you know, we too are part of nature.
Well, it's pretty clear to me that the vault, even though the reason for it is, I mean, the little impermeable barrier, the reason that they give is for lawnmowers, but it's pretty clear to me that that is tied into the whole pyramid notion. I mean, you have this tomb that will then supposedly last forever.
Exactly. And in fact, you know, it's true because even though the cemeteries, you know, ask any cemeterian, they'll tell you that that's why they require it. But if you go on, you know, if you go on the vault websites, for instance, and Wilbert is one of the largest vault manufacturers in the U.S., they don't deny that this is the reason why they're used, but they also sell it as a promise of protection to the families, showing images of caskets that have been put in the ground without a vault, that have crumbled and have, you know, allowed what's outside to come inside and what's inside to get outside. So I think, you know, you're absolutely right that even the vault companies are selling this to families, even though the cemeteries require it for this mechanistic reason, right? Selling it to families with the idea that, you know, this is about ultimate protection for your loved one.
And so it reminds me too of, I mean, one of the things I loved about your book, and one of the reasons that I was so delighted and honored to give you a blurb for it, is that you're very clear about the importance of giving back to the world. And that's one of the things that's always annoyed me about embalming or anything else, is that they seem to be an abrogation of the fundamental bargain that we have with the world, which is that the price I pay for this, my entry ticket that I have to pay for to get into this wonderful party called life, is that I have to pay with my own body at the end.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you hear this in the voices of green burial advocates or people who choose green burial or want to choose it if they have the option in their community because, you know, it's not available everywhere, that, you know, they see it ultimately, for many of them, it's really sort of the ultimate recycling project. I mean, for lack of a better word, but many folks refer to it that way. You know, that I talk about two anthropologists in my book, Davis and Rumble, who have been charting the flow of woodland burials in the UK that started really in the early 1990s, you know, green burial in the UK. And, you know, they make the case in their writings for exactly this, that really green burial is ultimately about, you know, gift giving, and that in any really equitable, mutual, healthy relationship, you know, gift giving is a necessity. And we've really been robbed of the opportunity to enter into a relationship, an equitable, mutual relationship with the earth by way of our death practices, because we've been robbed of being able to give the gift back. And so we take and we take and we take, and we're given and we're given and we're given, but we never get to return. And so I think ultimately, I mean, it's hard to disagree with that, but that really is fundamentally what it is for many folks, and really what is perhaps, you know, the greatest promise of green burial, regardless of why people are choosing it.
You know, I under current laws, this couldn't happen, but honestly, what I really want to have happen when I die is I want to be eaten by bears.
Yeah.
Or,
you know,
or salamander. I don't actually care. You know, I'll be dead. Or vultures and hawks and slugs, you know, it's.
Well, you know, I love that you say that, because I feel like one of the wonderful things about, you know, greening death or the, you know, the green burial movement, or the fact that people are having these conversations, is that people are beginning to think of other ways in which they might be able to potentially dispose of their bodies. I know a woman actually who wanted to donate her body to a large game preserve, and they said no. This was recent. But the real question to that is, why not? Like, you know, there's a woman, I don't know if you're familiar with her, in Seattle right now, Katrina Spade, who's developing a prototype for what only can be described as, I talk about her in the book, as a human composting machine. And she's very keyed into developing ritual around this and bringing the family into the fold of this process. But when some people hear this, they think, you know, turning my body into compost in a chamber, like, that sounds crazy. And for other people, they're like, that sounds fantastic. For many folks, they find it to be disturbing because, unlike in a crematory, in her model, in a crematory, you know, the body is burned and then, you know, you get back, supposedly, you're supposed to, the ashes of whoever that person is, of grandma. But in her prototype, the body is composted, and then that compost is mixed in with everybody's compost, right? This idea of the one returning to the many. And it's hard for many people to get past, you know, that notion, because we have these very fixed ideas of what's acceptable in terms of the disposition of the dead. But I think, you know, your point is a really wonderful point, because I think what happens in these conversations around greening death is it starts generating all of these questions like, well, why can't we do that? Maybe there are other ways we can dispose of the dead that we really haven't thought of that are actually very earth-friendly.
Well, we've heard about sky burials.
Right, exactly.
And
we don't do that here.
Yeah, for people who don't know, why don't you mention that briefly?
Yeah, it's a practice that happens in certain parts of India and Tibet, where the body is taken up to a high point on a building, and I believe in most cases there are Tibetan monks, I think, that strip the body of its flesh, and then predators, birds, right, come out and pick the bones clean, ultimately, of what's left. And for those folks who have witnessed it, they've talked about the bones being, like, literally picked completely clean. And so, no, we don't practice that here in the U.S. anywhere. I mean, we don't practice open pyre burning with any regularity either. There's only one place in the U.S. that actually allows it right now, in Colorado, about 11 a year. And while burning, you know, is polluting in many ways, the question is, well, what? But even still, why don't we? You know, like, why are we restricted to the disposition practices that we have?
Do you want to talk? Do you think we've hit it enough, or do you want to talk any more about this culture's fear of death and the attempts to conquer death?
I don't know. Are there other parts that you want me to chat about?
Well, there's one other thing that occurs to me that is something that that has stuck with me for about 20 years since I read this in the newspaper, that there was some guy, I lived in Spokane, Washington, and there was a guy who killed his daughter.
Okay.
And he was a murderer. I mean, he was horrible. And then he took her body out, and he put it in the forest to hide it from the police. And the point is that when he was sentenced, the judge, sentenced him to imprisonment for a long, long time because of the murder. But what really made the judge mad was that he said her body was eaten by wild animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I see this, you know, my mom and I sometimes watch these sort of true crime dramas that are on television, and you'll see the same thing a lot, that they will talk about the horror of some murder, but then what's really terrible is they left the body out for animals.
Right.
And I'm just saying that in terms of how much this culture does not want to give back to the land.
It's true. I mean, I spent some time in the earlier part of the book talking about, you know, does the dead body matter? And I talk about, you know, how death practices are really culturally specific and time specific. And I really try to make the point, you know, very clear that I'm not suggesting that by doing these trio of practices that we have not been caring for the dead. I think that all of these gestures have been gestures of care for the dead, and that when the dead are not cared for, and I give lots of examples of when the dead are not cared for. And I think that even though in the case that you're citing here, right, we have an example where the dead body matters in terms of it mattering to nature, but it didn't matter in terms of the extension of the human culture that this woman had, that this young woman, I don't know how old she was, if she was a child, had not had a proper burial, right? That she had not been seen off properly. So the judge's disgust at what had happened to her really shouldn't have been centered on the fact that she had been eaten by wild animals, which of course, as you're pointing out, is natural. I think that the reason why we should feel any disgust of what had happened in addition to the murder was the fact that she wasn't, her life wasn't dignified with proper disposition, which meant that we saw her off in some way, which is something that humans, you know, this is also what green burial is about bringing people back into the fold, to recognize, you know, this passage, this essential passage into death. So, does that make sense?
Oh, it makes perfect sense. And thank you for saying, I think that's a wonderful point.
Yeah.
And we have about, 8 or 10 minutes left, and there's a couple directions that I want to ask you about. One of them is, so what is sort of the current state of legality of various forms of green burial or green care of the dead in the U.S. and or other countries?
Yeah, so in the U.S., and my book is focused on the U.S., but in the U.S., there really are no ultimately, there are very few legal barriers that get in the way of the development of a green or natural burial ground. So there are no laws really that require embalming, for instance. There are cemetery regulations that require the use of the vaults. That is really the big thing. And that's really the tough thing to get around. If you're starting a green burial ground from scratch, and you're not piggybacking on an existing cemetery, you know, both in terms of infrastructure or in terms of land, you know, you'll have a much easier time. But in cemeteries where there are these very strong regulations, again, these are not state or federal laws, around the use of the cemetery vault, you know, there's always a challenge. There's just a woman actually in Medford, Massachusetts, who was challenging her municipal cemetery to have her husband buried in the municipal cemetery to have a green burial in that cemetery. And they haven't buried him yet. He died several weeks ago. And I think they're having a meeting next month, another town meeting to discuss this. And I think she's waiting. She's waiting because she really wants him buried there. But they do not, I think, want to lift the cemetery vault requirement because of the lawnmower, the lawnmower issue that we talked about before. So a lot of it has to do with cemetery regulations. But in terms of state and federal laws, not so much. Those barriers aren't there. The barriers that exist in terms of the development of green burial grounds have less to do with the law and more to do really with, access to land, access to money to set up cemeteries, you know, the resistance from the funeral industry, that type of thing.
It is legendary among environmentalists at this point that, Edward Abbey's body was stolen and by his friends and taken out to the desert to decompose.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think about this more and more, and I talk about this some with my mom because she's 83 and she's in good health, but, you know, this is, we're entering the phase where this is a subject of conversation.
Yeah.
And she loves the land where we live here and would love to be a part of it. And, you know, forget the fact that we live in California. I mean, is that possible anywhere in the United States for people to be buried on their own land?
It is, yes. Backyard burial, as it's called, is absolutely possible. You have to check your local ordinances, but it is absolutely possible in many, 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 many places. The main thing is that anytime you put a body into the ground, that location becomes forever, and I say forever because we have lots of examples in the U.S. of digging up, you know, indigenous burial grounds, but burials are supposed to designate a forever cemetery spot. And so that has to be marked as a cemetery forever, you know, in perpetuity. And there are regulations usually by way of the state regulations that tell you, you know, the parameters of the cemetery. And for some people, you know, this is great if you've got a lot of land. For other people, it's not so great because there's the matter of resale. You know, can you sell your property? You know, if you've got an acre of land and you buried, you know, your grandmother in the backyard, some people might not want to buy the house later. So, you know, the idea of a communal cemetery, you know, is perhaps more appealing to some people because of that.
So what can people do? We have like still 5 minutes. What can people do? So individually, if someone wants, okay, I've got two questions still. What can people do socially to help promote this? And also individually, you know, people like myself or my mother, you know, who are starting this discussion of what to do with themselves personally, what can they do individually? What should they do individually?
Yeah, I think on the individual level, it really starts with, you know, the conversation. And so that if people want a green burial, pre-planning is really necessary. I don't necessarily mean pre-planning in terms of you have to go out and buy a plot. I mean, letting people in your family know exactly what it is that you want done. And if you are going to be using a funeral director, and there are 10 states in the U.S. that impede a family's right to care for their dead completely on their own. New York State actually is one of them where I live. And so you'll want to check into that within the state that you live in to see what, if you do have to hire a licensed funeral director for part of the funeral. And if you do, for part of the care for the dead, and if you do, it would be also important to before you die, find a funeral director who will see to your final wishes, because you know, when someone dies and someone says, oh, well, they wanted a green burial, and you go to a non-green friendly funeral director, they may push you in a direction that you didn't necessarily want, or, you know, make it seem as though what you want isn't actually possible. So that's the first thing, I think, you know, the pre-planning, having the conversation, letting people know what it is that you want, and then, you know, trying to find a funeral director who might see to this later on, or finding a few of them, having conversations with funeral directors in your community if you need to hire one. If people are interested in green burial, I think that, you know, some of the best places to look are to the Green Burial Council. The Green Burial Council is a third-party verification organization. It's a 501c3 that set itself up in 2005 to set standards for burgeoning green burial grounds. And they have three levels of certification for green burial grounds that more or less focus on land conservation. The highest tier has a real focus on land conservation. For those folks who are very interested in buying a burial plot in a cemetery that's very much focused on care of the land, as opposed to at the bottom, a cemetery that offers green burial in its most basic form, as I described it, but isn't so concerned with what's going on above ground. So you might have ultimately that manicured look. So there's a range in green burial grounds that exist in the U.S. right now. The Green Burial Council is a great place to look for green burial grounds. They have a list of certified providers at their website. A more extended list of green burial grounds can be found at the National Home Funeral Alliance website. Those are certified and uncertified burial grounds. And these are all listed state by state. Right now, like I said, there are over probably 100 green burial grounds in the U.S. And so right now, even though someone might want a green burial, chances are access to one in your community is unlikely. And so, you know, pressuring your cemeteries to provide at the minimum a burial without a vault, I think is some advocacy that can happen on the local level, like this woman did in Medford, Massachusetts recently. The cemetery that was started in my hometown, which is also a natural municipal cemetery, while it was led by a group of us, actually started because there were community members that went to the town and said, you know, I'm interested in green burial. So, you know, I think pushing the parameters, you know, movements are made, you know, it's all about motion. And so, you know, how do you get going is, you know, there's a variety of ways, but this movement is really happening at the grassroots level with people sort of like pushing in their own communities.
So what are you hoping to accomplish with your work in this field? What are you hoping to accomplish on a sort of immediate or superficial level? And what are you hoping to accomplish on a more, or I shouldn't say superficial, but on a tangible level, what are you hoping to accomplish? And then on the level of a fundamental change in society, what are you hoping to accomplish?
Well, I guess I'll answer the last part first. You know, we are, you know, environmentalists have told us for a long time, Val Plumwood, whose work I draw from a lot in the book, Neil Everdeen, you know, Vandana Shiva, these folks, we recognize, Aldo Leopold, that, you know, we are desperately in need of practices that give us a way of understanding that we too are part of nature. We need practices that give us a great vantage point to see that we are tied to the earth, that we are living in partnership with the more than human world. And, you know, for too long now, our death practices, something that faces all of us, you know, we've been robbed of this possibility. And so this is really, as I say in the book, this is green burial's greatest promise. And it seems simple, you know, but the fact is that it does give us this view of nature that we are, it's not the only way that we can get this view, obviously, but it does give us a firsthand view of our relationship to the land, of our relationship to the land community, our place within the land community. And so that, of course, always makes me feel really heartened and good about what's happening with this movement. At the more superficial level, at the more basic level, I think that we have a lot of barriers that the green burial movement is facing in terms of the development of green burial grounds and the spread, basically, of the word. And so more education needs to happen, obviously. There's always education that's the heart of any movement. But more green burial grounds need to be built, and they need to be built also with conservation in mind. And how are disparate communities in the U.S. Making sense of green burial on their own terms? And how will they come to make sense of green burial on their own terms remains to be seen. But we have many challenges that we're facing in terms of fomenting a stronger movement. And so this is what I see in the near future in terms of taking those on.
You know, I think one of the most important questions that any of us can ask is the world, the real physical world, a better place because you were born? And I think that one of the wonderful things about your book is it also asks us to ask the very important question, is the real physical world a better place because you died?
It's true. So true. That is so true.
Well, yeah. is there anything else you want to say before we wrap up?
No, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being on the program. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Suzanne Kelly. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.